alive and kicking
on News Talk.
Thanks to ReproMed, IVF and fertility experts with clinics nationwide. Begin your fertility journey at ReproMed.ie.
And this is Alive and Kicking. You can text the show 53106 at a cost of 30 cents. You can email aliveandkicking@newstalk.com or you'll find me on Twitter and Instagram. I'm at Claire's Lair. Coming up this morning, migraines and how to get through them, why loneliness in middle-aged men is a serious threat to their health, and how good, healthy, home-cooked food can help in a crisis. I'll bring you the family story behind Kayla's Kitchen. So what kind of a health and wellness week did I have? Well, I'd have to say it was fairly Halloween filled. I spent a few days in Derrier earlier in the week. They go large at Halloween. I was there with Ireland AM last year. And so this year I brought my family up for a bit of a break for their Awakening of the Walls festival, which I would highly recommend. Now, with Brexit and the talk of a hard border and the deadline of the 31st of October being Halloween looming, over the year, whether or not we were going was hanging in the balance for me. Now, mainly I was thinking of restless kids after a 3-hour journey from Dublin in a car, and if there was going to be a bedding in time of possible border checks, that I wouldn't want to be sitting in the car with them, or none of us would make it. But in my mind also was the thought of possible unrest in the north. And I don't want to do Derry a disservice. I've been there 3 times and never at any time did I feel anything but safe in a gorgeous city with gorgeous people. But I myself and my husband were in Paris back in 2015 for the Bataclan attacks. And while we were in no way caught up in the horrendous happenings of that night, we were holed up in our hotel watching the television, watching François Hollande declare a state of emergency. And I certainly did feel the terror. And I think it's clouded how I feel since then, particularly when it comes to bringing my kids places. And I've even considered it as close to home as going to London. Now, I do think we learned from the Ariana Grande concert in Manchester that, you know, terrorism and the unexpected can strike anywhere when you least expect it. And obviously, in my thought process, common sense prevails. I mean, if you wanted to really protect your kids, you just wrap them in cotton wool and never leave the house. And even then, don't they say 99% of accidents happen in the home? So you wouldn't even be safe there. And with the way mine squabble, you know, we'd definitely be risking our lives by staying in and never leaving. So I do obviously continue, and we went to Derry, as I said, and had a great time. But I have noticed a real difference in my thinking. I would even be more conscious now of driving a long journey and think about my carbon footprint. Likewise, when I fly somewhere. So it's just this woke generation, isn't it? It's great to be aware, but Christ, it can be exhausting. And I did more travelling. I went to Trim in Meath last night for a concert as part of their Pooka Festival. But it was cancelled last night due to the absolutely biblical rain. So I ended up in a pub drinking water and watching Katie Taylor. Now, I find boxing quite uncomfortable to watch. I'm a bit of a wuss and I just start worrying about anybody's injuries or Katie's swollen eye. I start panicking. But to be fair, she seemed fine. And I am nonetheless marvelling at the sheer strength and fitness of both in the ring and the strength and determination of Katie's mind. Very impressive performance in both areas. And I saw online this morning performance psychologist Jerry Hussey, who was a guest on this show. He described it as a performance of skill, composure and years of perfecting her art, and that Katie Taylor is a living lesson for all and all we wish for in our sport and our country. So yes, congrats on making history as a two-weight champion, Katie. You can text the show 53106 at a cost of 30 cents. You can email aliveandkicking@newstalk.com or you'll find me on Twitter and Instagram. I'm at Claire Zelaire. So the world of Paula Hughes and Emmett Harton was turned upside down when, age 2, their beloved daughter Kayla was diagnosed with Rett syndrome, a rare neurological disorder that affects how the brain develops. And in an interview, the couple said that there was nothing positive about the syndrome, but of course, there are many positives about Kayla herself. And along with their second daughter, Jamie, the family have found a way to live this new normal and even find business inspiration with their meal delivery service, Kayla's Kitchen. We'll get to more of that in a moment, but Paula and Emmett join me in studio now. Well, you're very welcome. Thank you very much.
Thank you for inviting us in.
And the girls are outside. What kind of ordeal was it for you to get in here today? I mean, is getting out of the house an ordeal?
It's a bit of an operation. You can't just pick up a bag and run out.
You have to think through all the different things that Kayla's going to need or could happen to Kayla during the day, put it all together, and then get her into the car, and then you're ready to go. That's probably half an hour.
Yeah. So I'm very grateful to you for coming in. And Kayla's 10 now.
11.
11.
Yes.
Wow. And how is she?
She's amazing. She's mostly a happy, loving, giggly 11-year-old, you know, with Rett syndrome. So she's nonverbal. She doesn't have hand use. But she lights up a room with her smile and with her eye contact. She communicates with us and with people around her. But she's a fantastic child and inspiring.
And she uses the eye gaze technology to communicate.
Yes.
And reading about you, and you went to meet a leading neurologist in New York, and he said a line that really kind of struck me: never underestimate her will and ability to communicate. And I think people can do that from time to time, can't they?
Yeah. Oh, it's very important. We're constantly trying to drum that into every carer and every, the assistants and the teachers in the school. Do not underestimate. Always try and find the limit of what she's capable of, rather than just sitting back and going through the motions of what should a child with severe to profound challenges have at the age of 10. The risk is always that they'll end up just doing 4 and 5 year old stuff, whereas Kayla is in some respects 11 and beyond, and in other respects, you know, she's a bit all over the map. None of these Derbyshire tests or any of these standardized tests that they have really apply to Kayla, because you can find that she's developed to the age of 5 and something, but on the other hand, you can find that she's developed at the age of 11, 12 and further on in many other things.
Yeah.
So never underestimate. You must always test.
Yeah, and don't underestimate what she's taking in. So look her in the eye, say hello, don't speak over her head. That's what I would imagine as a parent is really important.
Yeah. It's a mantra for us.
They sometimes describe Rett syndrome as a locked-in syndrome. So that she's locked in, she can't communicate out, she can't, sometimes has difficulty processing the world around her. But everything goes in. It's just, it's hard for her to communicate it back out to us.
So can you explain a little bit more about it? So she was developing as a baby and hitting all the markers, and then things began to change.
Sure. So she developed typically till the age, I'd say 13 months. And it was like overnight she stopped developing. Just those toys that, you know, babies will play with and are engaged with. She got to a stage where she just stopped engaging with them and slowly started to regress. Things started to go into the mouth. She wasn't communicating in the same way that she had been, and she wasn't as engaged, and she wasn't, we were losing a little bit of her character. And that's when we started to get worried, and we got the advice. She went into early services and they assessed her and said, yes, there is cause for concern. And then we brought her to a neurologist and a paediatrician, and they did some tests, and 9 months later we get the diagnosis of Rett syndrome.
And what's it like then to become an expert, or have to become an expert, and meet all these specialists? I mean, having a kid alone turns your life upside down. To take on that as well, I mean, it can't have been easy.
Oh, it's a strain. It's a brain strain, because you're learning new terminology, new language. You're getting a crash course in areas of medicine, and, you know, faster than a doctor would, because you've got an urgency about it. So, you know, you're searching for what can I learn as fast as possible to do as much as possible as soon as possible for my kid. So, you know, you're going into the nutrition, which is one of our huge things, but you're searching for anything and everything that could be of any use, either in understanding what's happening or in what you can do to help or to take some sort of constructive action.
And 3 years after Kayla was born, you had Jamie, who's also here this morning, and mm-hmm. she's brought joy to everyone's life, mm-hmm. including Kayla. And I think it's probably incredible. I certainly notice it on a smaller scale with my own kids, with kids with special needs in their classroom alongside it. When you don't know any different, you don't notice any different. And I just think it's a great lesson in compassion for anybody to have. And it must be incredible for you to see the relationship grow between the two of them.
Yes, sometimes, you know, Jamie could be a little bit more patient with Kayla, but we hope we're getting there.
But she's eight.
Yeah, she's so, eight.
You know, she's got an eight-year-old's set of, how do you say, personal skills.
We're very aware
but she,
of it.
But she does have a little bit more heightened awareness of other kids who have issues as well. It's how she describes it, say in her school. It's a non-denomination, it's a Brace School project, and they're fantastic with kids with needs, and you can see it in all the kids, and Jamie particularly, we see it, how she's far more accommodating and more mindful of what another kid will need, whether it really, even if it's not special needs, she's far more mindful of how to accommodate other kids.
And even, sibling rivalry is difficult in all homes up and down the country. So isn't it great that she doesn't have extra patience? She just treats Kayla like her sister, like she would any time. So during all of this, you touched on nutrition there, Emmett. You began to work with the nutritionists and the dietitians at the National Children's Hospital in Tala, because I'm always really fascinated as food, as medicine, and this is something that you began to lean towards.
Yes. From the outset, we were aware of the importance of nutrition in establishing a good firm basis and a good start for Kayla and for any kid with Rett syndrome. They have a particular problem with gleaning the nutrition from a typical diet. So, you know, we'd heard horror stories of Rett girls dying of malnutrition on a typical diet.
Because only girls get Rett syndrome, isn't that correct?
Only there are one or two boys in the world who have survived to say 10 or 12 with it, but it impacts on a boy far heavier, and most of them never get to full-term pregnancy, which is why it's generally perceived as just a female condition. So that's why we say, you know, girls at rest with this and that and the other. So we heard these horror stories about the nutrition, and we thought we're not going to let that happen. So Paula set it up for me to go and visit a nutritionist, a private nutritionist, once a week with Kayla. And I think I can't remember, maybe seven sessions, an hour each. And we'd go away and do our homework, myself and Kayla, just trying out the food, seeing what she'd eat, what she'd not eat. And one of the things that transpired, we were very lucky that she only has one or two texture aversions. You can get very caught up with kids who won't accept, you know, crunchy stuff, rubbery stuff, dry stuff. That can be a horror story. But with Kayla, she has a fantastic palate, and the only thing she really won't eat are eggs, rubbery boiled eggs. Just, she'll spit them out. So following on from the nutritionist, we worked very closely with the dietitians in Tala Hospital, and they set us up really, really well.
And around that time, Paula, your brother was diagnosed with motor neuron disease, and obviously you were both reeling from the diagnosis of Kayla, and you weren't able to be there necessarily for him physically in the way you would have wanted to, and you had elderly parents, and food became a bit of a connector. You were cooking meals at home and sending them there. And is that where the inspiration for Kayla's Kitchen came from?
Yeah, I suppose Emmett loves cooking. I love eating.
The perfect match.
I also love being with my family. I love being, you know, taking care of my brother, taking care of my parents. But I don't necessarily want to spend the time in the kitchen and shopping. I want to be with them. So that's where it was the perfect match. Emmett was making all this food. He'd batch cook it, put it in the freezer. I was able to feed my parents, my brother, Kayla. And I suppose when we had the diagnosis with Kayla, you know, we were in a terrible state for about 2 years where we didn't sleep. If somebody had arrived at our door with a hamper of food, we'd be still thanking them. So I think that was the inspiration on its own. You know, how can we help other families go through what we've been going through?
Because food is a real human connector, but that idea of food being medicine, it is so important when people are vulnerable. I read an interview with the two of you from last year, and you quoted 140,000 people were living in the country suffering malnutrition from illness. And that is just an incredible figure.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. And I mean, the doctors, I've been in and out of hospitals pretty much all my life. And I remember back in the mid 80s, a doctor telling me, he says, by the time we get out of here, you're going to be anemic. She was looking at me. I was already turning anemic. I was quite ill anyhow. But she said, our food in the hospital is going to make you anemic. You're going to be in a pretty poor state by the time you leave. And that was back in the 80s, and nothing has happened since. What's happening is people are leaving care having not been fed the particular nutrition that they need for their condition to put them in a good state to recover.
Then they get home, they're vulnerable, they're ill, they're recovering, they're not going to stand for hours chopping and shopping and all of that.
And as a first step, they're probably not going to be inclined to do all the reading and studying to find out what foods are best for restoring them.
And that's what you've done, because the meals on Kayla's Kitchen, I mean, they're all tasty, there's a wide variety there, but they are nutritionally balanced specifically for illness. Or people recovering?
They are nutritionally balanced meals. There's two things to the food I make. One is that it's got to be really, really tasty, because it's got to bring a bit of joy. Food, it needs to be, whether you're chronically ill or not, it needs to be a thing, or it should be a thing, that brings a bit of joy, that you should enjoy what you eat. You do it at least three times a day. You got to be enjoying it.
I do it more
for a quality of life. You hear about people and they're not happy. They're depressed or whatever. Food goes out the window. I think food is a source of joy from start of day to the end of the day, and then we should all be eating nutritionally balanced food, and that's the basis. The food is really, really good, and for people who are suffering from particular conditions or recovering from particular conditions, but it's just as good for people who just want to eat well every day of the week. And that's the core principle of it. I mean, the idea evolved from our household, where, as you say, we had Carl, who'd been diagnosed with motor neurone disease, Paula's parents, in fact, as well. Paula's mother broke her hip and wasn't able to stand at a cooker any longer. And then Paula was away about at least half of the year for 2 or 3 years after Kayla was diagnosed. So I was a quasi-lone parent for long stretches, trying to put fresh, proper, balanced food on the table each evening for Kayla and Jamie. And Carl kept showing up looking for a takeaway. It's kind of how it evolved. And the only sensible thing to do was get Kayla out to special needs school in the morning, get Jamie occupied on the floor rattling something, and start making big batches of food that I felt would freeze and then come out of it just as good as when it went into the freezer. And that was one of the key starting points of Kayla's Kitchen, was figuring out what food is carrying all the nutrition we need, what's going to be as nutritional when it comes out of the freezer and as tasty. So I try out dishes and they'd go by the wayside, and other dishes became regulars. And then another part of the whole philosophy with Kayla is that it's one of the few things that she can enjoy actively herself is flavour, one of her senses. Like, she enjoys looking at visually stimulating things like running water or trees and the wind. Storms, rainstorms are a big entertainment factor for Kayla.
There's plenty of them around here.
Yes, she's in the right country for it.
Well, I think it's incredible. I really do, that you took this and this is what was born from it. The service delivers nationwide, as they mentioned, and you can find out more at kaylaskitchen.ie. Paula Hughes and Emmett Harden, thank you very, very much.
Thank you for having
us. Thank you.
Aren't they just the most amazing family? Now, coming up, if you suffer from migraines and have a question for our expert, Esther Tompkins, clinical nurse specialist at the Migraine Clinic in Beaumont Hospital in Dublin, text them in 53106 for 30 cent, or you can email aliveandkicking@newstalk.com. Esther will join me in studio after this short break.
Alive and kicking on Newstalk.
Thanks to ReproMed, IVF and fertility experts with clinics nationwide. Begin your fertility journey at ReproMed.ie.
And you can text the show 53106 at a cost of 30 cent, or you can email aliveandkicking@newstalk.com. Now, it's estimated that 700,000 people in Ireland suffer from migraine. But what are migraines and what can we do to tackle them? Well, I'm joined by Esther Tompkins. She's a clinical nurse specialist at the Migraine Clinic in Beaumont in Dublin to learn more about the condition and how we can treat it. Well, good morning, Esther.
Good morning.
And every time I've mentioned migraine so far in the show, I've used the term suffer. And it is a sufferance, isn't it? Because a migraine is a good step on from a headache.
Yeah, well, migraine tends to last from 4 to 72 hours, so up to 3 days. So patients that suffer with migraine, episodic migraine, they experience usually a one-sided throbbing or pulsating headache with associated symptoms of a heightened sensitivity to light and sound, and also nausea. A certain percentage will actually vomit. And this builds up over a course of a number of hours and days. So yes, it can be very disabling and debilitating. But for most people, it's when it becomes more chronic, where they're experiencing daily or near daily symptoms of migraine. That's where the real disability and the effect of a negative impact on their quality of life really begins to affect these patients.
So what's going on when somebody has a migraine, and how does that differ from a headache? Are both neurological issues?
Yeah, so we know that it is a brain disorder, or there is a neurobiology to a migraine headache. And we also know that there is a familial link. So there's quite a strong genetic link to migraine. And it's one of the first questions that we ask a patient when we take a history is, you know, is there a family history of migraine? And this is really important to take that accurate history in terms of making the diagnosis of migraine. So for patients that think that they are experiencing a migraine attack, then it's really important to go and get a proper diagnosis with your GP, or also look for credible information from the likes of the Migraine Association of Ireland. This is somewhere where people can get very credible information.
Do you think if you suffer from them regularly, you should keep a diary of them when you get them, what you were doing that day? So when you come to the clinic, when you get to that point, you have a mapped history, because often we think we'll remember things, but you forget the severity, you forget the length of time, you forget what you were doing that day. Is it important to write things down?
Absolutely. And the Migraine Association of Ireland have a fantastic diary, a headache diary. So this is really important. And it identifies a pattern as well for many patients, and they start to recognise a trend with it. So sometimes it's the company that the headache keeps as well. So is it at the time of stress? Is it at the time when you skipped meals? Is it menstrually related? You know, was it at the time where there was a combination of trigger factors there in the background? And this can be really helpful for patients.
How much does food impact, or what you're eating or not eating, impact on your migraine?
Yeah, I tend to tell patients, you know, when you keep the diary, and the dietary trigger comes up all the time, you have to be careful. It tends to be when you eat, not what you eat. So if you skip meals, and this is really important even for adolescents and children who have migraine, don't skip breakfast, don't skip your lunch, because if you go for too long, it tends to be blood sugar related that you actually begin to get a migraine. There are certain foods that patients do identify with, but for us, it's more what you eat, or when you eat, than what you eat.
And it's more common in women. Why is that?
Yeah, 3 times more common in women than men. We think that this is hormonally linked. A lot of migraineurs identify with puberty being the trigger factor, or the sort of presenting factor of their migraine. History, when we take a history, if we look back, it tends to be around the time of the age of 8, 9, 10, when patients start to first experience their first migraine attacks with the onset of puberty. So yeah, that's quite typical of migraine.
So when somebody comes to the clinic, I mean, they're looking for you to have a magic wand, but it's a manageable condition, but there is no cure.
That's right. Yeah. So this is management. So there are different self-help techniques that we teach our patients. We also look at acute and preventative drug therapy. It's very important to have a correct diagnosis. This is really helpful for patients, especially if the attacks are more chronic. And this is really important in terms of keeping a diary. So if you tend to need to come to a more specialized service, then keep a record for a number of months before you actually attend. And yes, migraine tends to improve with age and through menopause for many women. And this is reassuring for many, but not for those who are maybe in their 30s or 40s presenting with quite chronic forms. But we have lots of new treatment options that are here now that we didn't have 10 years ago or even 20 years ago. So it's a good time to presenting to our services with that we can give hope with a lot of the newer treatment options that are now available.
And what is a migraine with an aura and without an aura? Because the aura is spoken about in a different form.
That's right.
Than we'd often hear it.
Yeah, so the aura affects about 20% of migraine patients. The most common type is migraine without aura. For those that experience the aura, it's usually visual. It can be sensory or it can affect speech. Usually patients present with a visual aura, usually at the side of their vision. This can be present as shapes that get bigger, smaller, change in size, they sparkle. This can last a number of minutes and is reversible within an hour. Also, numbness, pins and needles, it can present in the fingers, into the hand, also on the side of the face. And then word articulation difficulty, word finding difficulty. So these are the aura features. They can be quite frightening. Very often these patients want to have reassurance that nothing else is causing these symptoms. So that's probably the more neurological signs of a migraine aura, yeah.
And that's got to be very debilitating for, you know, a young person studying, for a parent, for somebody working. Because if you just have to take to a darkened room, that's having a massive impact on your life if this is happening on a regular basis.
Absolutely. And, you know, we have very good acute treatments now. We also have very good preventative treatments. So getting the right information, getting the appropriate drug therapy that will work for you is very important. We combine a lot of these acute treatments now that gives a more effective result for patients. Early intervention with your acute treatment is also really important, not to leave it. The longer you leave it, the less effective these treatments become. So you have more of a chance that the attack will last for longer. So having that advice and getting that information is really important.
And you said to me you're working in this area for 20 years, is
yes,
that right?
Yeah.
You don't look old enough to be doing that. You must have started when you were three, Esther. But have things changed over those 20 years? Have you seen major developments in the area?
Yes, we have, especially in the last number of years. There have been a lot of very positive developments in terms of both acute and preventative drug therapy. Unfortunately, a lot of these treatments are only available through the specialist services. But that even has changed. I mean, when I started, there was just one headache service in Ireland. Now there are a number in Galway, in Cork, a number in Dublin, in the major teaching hospitals, the Mat or Vince. Since Beaumont. So access to these services is still difficult, but it is now possible to access the services, the headache services.
Wow. Well, it sounds like it's certainly worth checking out. Do not suffer in silence, as they say. My thanks to Esther Tompkins, clinical nurse specialist at the Migraine Clinic in Beaumont Hospital in Dublin. Coming up, why loneliness in middle-aged men is a bigger health risk than diabetes and heart disease. And I'll meet the psychologist using walk and talk therapy to combat it.
Alive and kicking on News Talk.
Thanks to ReproMed, IVF and fertility experts with clinics nationwide. Begin your fertility journey at repromed.ie.
And you can text the show 53106 at a cost of 30 cents. You can email aliveandkicking@newstalk.com. Now, last year, research from the Men's Mental Health Forum in Ireland found that the suicide rate among middle-aged men is the highest of all age groups. A huge factor contributing to mental health difficulties for middle-aged men is loneliness. that they are struggling with isolation because they find it difficult to maintain friendships as they age, and it's having a negative effect on their lives. Well, Phil Gormley is a psychologist who runs a walk and talk therapy in the Phoenix Park and in Wicklow to help combat the issue and help men to open up. And he's here with me in studio to discuss. Well, you're very welcome this morning,
Phil.
How are you,
Phil? Claire? Just better correct that. I'm not a psychologist, psychotherapist.
Psychotherapist,
I beg your
pardon.
Going, he's not a psychologist, he's a psychotherapist. So there's a bit of a difference. Yeah.
I beg your pardon. No, it's important to get your title
absolutely,
correct.
Just in case, yeah.
And therapy, talk therapy is important, but it is hard to get the men to open up.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to get anybody to open up sometimes, but a lot of men maybe not used to talking, and that can be a difficulty, and you're trying to encourage people to talk. It's a real difficulty. I suppose that's maybe why the outdoor therapy can be a help, because you're walking side by side. There's like distance, so it is a bit intense, meaning you're face to face, but when you're not face to face, side by side, it does creates an environment that does be a bit easier to talk, you know.
This is really interesting because I was reading up on this during the week for our interview, and women favour face-to-face therapy. Now, we call it therapy as in, you know, when we talk to each other.
Yeah.
Whereas men prefer side-by-side, so to actually be doing something. So whether it's in a sport or anything like that men favour that kind of discussion.
Absolutely. I suppose that's why the men's sheds are good. People go on. I went to one myself one time. You'd be making things or working with things while you're talking. It's interesting, though, for the therapy side of it, from the outside door therapy, I see as many women as I do men. But I presume that's because more women probably go to therapy than men. But a lot of the men who do go, but a lot of the women who go as well will be of that nature, whereby talking might be a bit of a difficulty. And that side by side thing makes it easier, you know.
Do you think that we should all be going to some form of therapy as part of our, you try and eat your five portions of fruit and veg a day.
Yeah.
And once a month you go and talk to somebody objective about the little things and the big things that are going on in your life.
Well, I love this question because I have a theory about this, right? I reckon we don't need to go to therapy at all. We need to talk to each other more. We need to, see, we've this thing whereby we talk to each other, but we're not listening to each other. Like, I wouldn't have a job if everybody listened to each other. I just hear about walk and talk therapy. Now, this will put myself out of a job. But if everybody went for a walk in the local park, say me and you were pals, and we had an hour, and you the first half hour, and you were Claire, you're going to talk, and I'm not going to interrupt you. The most thing I'm going to do is go, yeah, okay, right. No interruption, no advice, no nothing, just listen to you. And then at the end of it, a 5 minute break just to relax, and then it's my turn, half an hour. If we did that once or twice a week, I'd be out of a job.
Because the interesting thing, if you do go to therapy, and I've been like in a couple situation, I've been on my own from time to time over the years, you don't actually give advice. As you
never.
Listen.
Oh, you wouldn't be, it'd be a poor therapist that would give advice. So I would never tell you should do or shouldn't do or whatever. No. And listening is probably, listening is like the base of it all. There is, in therapy, there's methods of, well, you're listening, I suppose, with a trained ear. But what does that mean?
And leading the conversation in certain ways.
Yeah.
And saying, well, why do you think you reacted that way?
Yeah, or, that type of stuff. Yeah.
But it is interesting that it's not advice that's needed. So even as friends to each other, we should just really listen to the person instead of, you know, trying to tell them what to do. And sometimes you do feel you don't know what to say to that person, or you don't know what they should do. But you don't need to know either of those things.
That's a brilliant point. How often would you be listening to your friend? Your friend is telling you something. Maybe they're hurting, maybe they're crying. And there's that sense of, geez, I better say something. I better do something to help May or your John here. But in actual fact, just as friends, we're probably better off if we just listen and go, jeez, I'm sorry to hear that.
Well, look, I only know what life is like as a woman, and we're always nattering about what's going on in our lives the most minute detail. Is it a cliche? Well, it can't be if these are the stats, and that's why I have you in front of me, that middle-aged men are finding it difficult to maintain their friendships. Why is that happening, do you think?
I can only give you my theory. I'm not a great man for research. I get so bored when I read it. Like, even this morning, I was trying to read a bit of stuff and I couldn't do it, you know.
I love your honesty.
Get me in trouble. But what I think is that as middle-aged men, see, I don't know what younger men are like now. The younger men look like they're talking to each other more. I don't know.
But like, what are we saying middle-aged men is, like 40s?
Well, I'm 45. I consider me middle-aged man. So yes. I suppose that'd be, 40 to late 40s is middle-aged. But I suppose my view of it is, we don't talk about the important stuff. We'll talk about football pints. We'll get a little bit, but we'll never talk about maybe the difficulties at home. I think girls do that stuff. We have difficulties at home, whether it was in the past or in the present. Men aren't talking about that stuff. We're not talking about stuff like women probably talk about sex, for example, more than men. Men probably talk about sex, maybe not, and sometimes not the healthiest way, and it gets them in trouble. It was on the news there last week. But men won't talk about erectile dysfunction premature ejaculation. They won't talk about any of that stuff. There's no way. But yet if men were talking about that and listened to each other, they'd be saying, oh, I know a way to sort that out. Because you'd be amazed how many people are depressed and they'll come to therapy and I'll hear it. A man will be there, he could maybe 10, 15 sessions and he'll be telling you about this and you're working hard and I'm confused going, what's going on here? And then he'll tell you, oh, I don't be able to get it up sometimes. And like, ah, now we've sorted the problem. And that could, 15 sessions is a long time beating around the bush, but it could have taken a man that length of time to get out. So yeah, if we were talking to each other, he could have saved himself 15 sessions. You know what I mean? So it's tricky.
And as a woman, the shared experience of other mothers, of other wives, of other workers always makes me feel that little bit better when somebody says, geez, that happens to me all the time or that's going on in my house as well. Because it's bigger. When you think it's only happening in your world, it only makes it bigger.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Oh, totally. I remember years ago now, I used to have panic attacks. It's sort of what got me into counselling myself. And I remember going to see a psychologist down at Lone. I remember him telling me, you'd be amazed the amount of students. I was in college at the time. He said, you'd be amazed the amount of students I see here as panic attacks. And that alone helped me feel better about it. But see, if you're a middle-aged man, and whether it's panic attacks or erectile dysfunction or whatever it might be, and the other huge amount of different bits and pieces, on your own, you think, I'm the only one who's suffering. I'm going mad in the head. And then because we're not talking to each other about it, you definitely think you're home. So I presume women have the advantage that if you're taking a panic attack or if you're having any difficulties, you're talking to your female mates about it. And you feel like you said, it's like I was in recovery for a long time. You go to your meetings and you sit in the meetings and it's a bit like that episode of Father Ted. I don't know if you remember, Father Jack walks into an AA meeting by mistake and everybody's sitting around nodding their heads. And while that was humorous and that's the truth, but that's why it helps, because everybody goes, oh yeah, I understand.
Yeah.
And that understanding makes a huge difference to us, you know.
Well, I suppose what's going on in middle-aged men's lives is, you know, things are settling down. The majority of people know what it is that they're doing in life. They may have settled into family life. And I certainly know in my own house, my husband is a very social, very happy chap, but he wouldn't keep up his friendships in the same way as I would with my girlfriends.
Yeah,
we make a lot of appointments to go for a lot of meals and a lot of times. And we will all say on the WhatsApp group, it's been a while, when are we meeting? And it's not really the same for the lads. Yeah. Well, why is that?
My only guess is, again, I haven't read what research said, but my only guess in it is literally not talking. Like in some ways, like therapy is easy for me as a therapist because it's literally just trying to get people to talk. Whether it be male, female, teenagers, whatever.
Just not having that on your priority list. I mean, we would literally say as girlfriends, we need a catch up. It's a need.
We need a catch up, right? That's what I have one pal that I do that with. This is what I do for a living, therapy. And I'm all for, we got to talk. I have only one pal that I would do that with. And even that, we don't do it that often. And me and him are both aware of it, that maybe every, and we're talking about once every 2 months we'll do it. But that's the only person I would do that. And I go around preaching this stuff. You know what I mean? So it must be a man thing where we're just not, is it a biological thing? I don't know if this is right or wrong to say, but women tend to talk more than men, I think.
Mm-hmm.
So then when we're with each other, do we talk even less? Probably. And then if we're talking less, there's less understanding. And that's the key word, is understanding. Because if I'm taking panic attacks or whatever particular issues I have, there's no understanding because I'm in here. I have a lovely analogy. Well, I think it's a lovely analogy. It's like a washing machine. If you put your clothes in the washing machine, you wash them. And then you put in another wash, but you use the same water to wash the last wash. The clothes come out and you go, why are these clothes dirty? It's because you use the same water. But if you're in here on your own all the time, just thinking on your own.
In your head.
It's just going around the same old dirty water. But at least if you're talking to somebody, and if the other person is only nodding, like you're doing now, listen to me, you're nodding. Oh, that in itself is helping me. That's why therapy can work. And that's why probably why such a suicide rate in men is so much higher than men. It's so much higher in men, probably because we're not doing that talking, which means there isn't that understanding.
So what about this walk and talk therapy that you do through places like the Phoenix Park and in the Wicklow Mountains?
Mm.
How does that work? And at what point do you introduce that to somebody that's sitting in front of you?
Oh, I don't. I rarely work in the office. Walk and talk's what I do full time.
Right.
So like I don't see people in the office and say, look, I think you'd be suitable. I advertise solely for walk and talk therapy. So like our first session, if you were coming to see me, our first session would be in the park, walking side by side, straight into it, no messing. So everybody comes, like the walk and talk therapy, it's not better than regular therapy. I'd never try and promote it that way or anything like that. But it suits certain people. There's people who don't, like me and you are face to face now, we're looking at eyes, but some people would be talking like this, you know, we wouldn't be able to make eye contact. So some people love that. Some people love that they can smoke a cigarette. Some people, a man in a wheelchair, he loves coming because he can push along in his wheelchair. It's just, it's a less intense form of therapy. and it's easier for people to talk. And as far as I'm concerned, that's the main point of therapy is if you're coming along and you can't talk, my job is to trick you into talking. I humorously use the word trick, but it is. It's tricky. Like, we can be walking along, we can talk about deers or squirrels for a while just to soften you up. And then another big question there is, what's the point in talking, and why might walk and talk therapy help some people? Because when you're talking out to somebody, you're starting to understand yourself better. And this is the problem for middle-aged men. But see, when I say middle-aged men, it's for all people. The problem is we don't understand ourselves. But by talking to another person, we start to understand ourselves better. And that's why, as a counsellor or psychotherapist, whatever, you don't need to advise someone. You just need to encourage them to talk. But then you would lead, as you said earlier on, you would lead with statements like, let's say somebody's talking to me and they're saying, I had 11 pints last night and then I had a couple of glasses of wine before I went to bed. I wouldn't tell them that's right or wrong, but I would ask leading questions like, what might that be doing to your health? What might that be doing to your head? So then they might go, and you'd be amazed how many people say, just never thought of that. You know, you might think 11 pints, of course, there's something wrong there, but some people mightn't see that. So the simple question of, oh, that's interesting. What do you think that's doing to you? And then go, never thought of it. So again, it's helping the person to understand. So that'd be why the walk and talk. Again, it's not that it's better than the office. It's just for people maybe of that nature. But then some people love being outside. Like, I love being outside. That's how I come up with the idea. So I love being outside and people feel more relaxed. And I was saying to you earlier on about cursing, you know, I always get in trouble for this. And I was nervous. I wasn't really nervous about coming here. I was nervous that I'd curse and get in trouble, you know.
It peppers so much of the Irish language.
I know. And that's the thing. And I do give this talk to Americans every year. And they think it's hilarious. They're so anti-cursing. When I curse them, they think it's really funny, you know. But I do say to clients, you know, I ask them, are you okay with some bad language? And they always say, of course I am. And again, it's about relaxing. It's about if you're relaxed, like you, if I come in here to chat with you and you make me all nervous and tell me, Phil, this is really important. We're on News Talk and you have to talk really well. I'll be planking it and it's going to be a really bad interview. But you've made me feel relaxed so I can talk. Although I can feel my heart beating fairly lively there. but you see, again, it's about making someone feel relaxed so they can talk and then ultimately understand themselves better.
And even being out in the open, people feel comfortable talking about sensitive subjects.
Yeah, that's an interesting point, because people always worry about going, oh, if you're outside, will a lot of people hear you?
And chances are you don't run into anybody or nobody can hear you. But I think I might be conscious of that.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a fair question. But again, when you're in the parks, first of all, nobody cares when anybody else is talking.
No.
If you were walking with somebody else, I'd have to walk beside you and really have my ear cocked to hear what you're saying. So nobody can really hear. And then we can, plenty of ways of dealing with that. You can walk off and... But again, the people who come, this is the thing about outdoor therapy as well. We're still we think mental health is at the forefront of things. I don't think it is really, because if it was, nobody would be worried about outdoor therapy. People are like, oh, there's people doing their therapy, isn't that brilliant? But some people are still nervous about it. But I think as we move forward, it'll be less and less of, you know, the stigma is still there a little bit around it.
Yeah, well, I think we're talking about it more and more.
Definitely.
An interview I did with Shirley Gleason. She's of Eco Wellness Consulting and she does forest bathing, just going for walks in the forest and really grounding yourself in it.
Yeah, it's mighty.
And she says 120 minutes out in nature is what we should be talking about for our mental health.
I listened to that one, yeah.
As much as we talk about the fruit and veg a day and all that sort of stuff. Yeah. So you're on the right track for sure. Even though it sounds like you're just pleasing yourself and helping others along the way.
Totally.
That's the key. Where can people find you, Phil?
Well, there's our website there, Walk and Talk Therapy. But you better, rather than finding me, get your pal and go out for half an hour each. Save yourself a load of money coming to see me and go out and just listen. Just listen to each other and don't try and tell the other person what to do. And you'll save yourself coming to me.
Good stuff. Sounds like you'd be a good pal to anyone. Psychotherapist Phil Gormley, thank you very, very much. That's it from Alive and Kicking today. My thanks to my producer, John Fardy, John O'Donovan standing in today. Jojo Cardoza was on sound. And thank you very much to Simon for all his research work this week. Vincent Wall's up next.
Alive and Kicking on News Talk.
Thanks to ReproMed, IVF and fertility experts with clinics nationwide. Begin your fertility journey at ReproMed.ie.